Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Hi, it's Lauren Smith here, the producer of The Brendan O'Neill Show. I just want to let you all know that Spike's internship program is now open for applications. We're looking for an aspiring journalist to join our team on a six-month paid full-time placement. You'd be working with us at the Spiked office in London, helping us with all our output, including articles, blogs, videos, and podcasts like this one. You don't need any prior experience to apply, but if you have worked in journalism before, or you know your way around video, audio, and social media management, then do make this clear in your application. Above all, we're looking for someone who has a passion for our pro-freedom, pro-human politics. Someone who's hardworking, dedicated, and willing to learn on the job. And someone who's got a good eye for a story and a flair for journalism. Everything else you can learn on the job. I started at Spiked as an intern, so I can highly recommend applying for this. It's an amazing experience, and you get to earn while doing something you love. There really is nowhere better to kickstart your career in journalism. To find out more and to apply, go to spiked-online.com/interns. That's spiked-online.com/interns. You have until Sunday, the 23rd of February, to apply. Good luck.
And the whole narrative that, you know, we're in sort of economic decline, whereas the EU is sort of sailing off confidently without us. Of course, that relies on us not looking too closely at what's going on across the channel. We've got Germany now sort of reintroducing border controls. Hungary's built a Donald Trump-style razor wire fence on its southern border to keep out the migrants. Europe seems stuck in this sort of pretty suicidal energy policy where it's putting net zero above all economic considerations and is sort of happy to lose its manufacturing industries and sort of impoverish its people as a result.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Ross Clark. Ross, welcome to the show.
Hello, Brendan.
It's great to have you back on, and we need to talk about your new book. Your new book is called Far From EU-topia, Why Europe is Failing and How Britain Could Do Better. The thing I really like about this book, it's like a kind of hand grenade of facts thrown into the discussion about post-Brexit Britain and post-Brexit Europe, in fact. And it really kind of explodes some of the narrative we've been told, especially from certain sections of the media, which is that after Brexit, Britain became the sick man of Europe. We became poorer, crazier, more hateful, less democratic, whereas Europe carried on being wonderful and lovely. And your book says that's not quite true. That's not really what has happened. So let's get into the meat of some of that. But I guess I want to start off by asking you why you thought it was important to challenge that narrative. What was it that compelled you? I mean, you've obviously been following this for some time, like lots of other people. But what compelled you to think, right, I've got to sit down and actually tackle this story?
Well, I think it's week after week since the Brexit, we've had this onslaught of sort of bad news stories which have been sort of attributed to Brexit. We had some empty supermarket shelves. Well, that was attributed to Brexit. Well, of course, it was, you know, supply chains were necessarily disrupted by the pandemic. And so, you know, there were shortages of some foods in the shops. And again, we have these tales that the economy is sinking. And the truth, you know, we aren't. The economy is flatlining. We're not doing well as an economy, but running far too high a debts. But, you know, I mean, the problem of government debt, for example, goes back 20 years. No government has balanced the books in 22 years. That's why we've got a, you know, enormous deficit. And the economy productivity stalled around 2010. Again, that's nothing to do with Brexit. And the whole narrative that, you know, we're in sort of economic decline, whereas the EU is sort of sailing off confidently without us. Of course, that relies on us not looking too closely at what's going on across the channel, where you find that Germany is just about to enter its third year of recession. France is up to its eyeballs in debt just as much as we are. And, you know, the economy, the continent is suffering the same sort of problems. Public services, NHS, for example. Well, you know, it's not a that different story in France. In the Netherlands, there's such a shortage of hospital beds for children that they're having to send patients to Belgium. Germany's had problems with the health service. We saw what the Italian health service was like during COVID and just completely unable to cope. So, you know, all these countries have similar problems to us. You know, the truth is that Britain and Europe are still sort of locked in this, you know, cycle of low economic growth. And we now have the chance to try and escape from that, put ourselves on a higher trajectory of growth. But we haven't as yet taken advantage of our Brexit freedoms.
Yeah, I think that's a really good starting point for the discussion. And the economic stuff, I want to come back to that in a moment because it is so striking. You know, this notion, the implicit idea is that Britain was in rude economic health prior to Brexit and everything went downhill after Brexit. And you think, well, you know, what Britain were these people living in? It's not as if the economy has been in good nick for some time. But before we get into some of that stuff, I want to cast your mind back, and I guess listeners' minds back, to 23rd of June 2016, or as you put it in the opening of the book, really the early hours of the morning on the 24th of June 2016. Britain had just voted to leave the European Union, and you capture very well the troubled sense amongst the kind of a commentariat, the political class, a real sense of panic, a real sense of dread. That moment when a kind of ashen-faced David Dimbleby announced to the nation that we'd voted to leave the EU. I mean, there was one of my all-time favourite TV moments, and I know other people didn't enjoy it so much. How long did it... Because you say in the book that you voted Remain. You put your cards on the table and you voted Remain. How long did it take you to clock back then, in June 2016, that the response to the vote was getting a bit crazy, and the people who said we need to row back on this vote, we need to overturn it, this is an absolute disaster. And as you point out, when a window was smashed in a restaurant, it was instantly chalked up to the new hatred that would spread in Britain as a result of Brexit. How long before you realised that the response was going to be a bit crazy and would require a bit more cool analysis?
Well, I think it began before the vote, really, before, we had, you know, these endless sort of modelled scenarios put up by sort of Remain-supporting think tanks, for example. And the Treasury put up a rather infamous piece of research, as it called it, in May 2016, a month before the vote, which predicted that unemployment would rise by 500,000. That's you know, within 2 years before we actually, Brexit had actually begun, and that the economy would shrink by 3.5%. And that's if we were lucky. They also came up with a severe shock scenario where unemployment increased by 800,000 and the economy shrank by 6%. Well, in the event, nothing even remotely like that happened. Within 2 years of the Brexit vote, the economy expanded, unemployment fell, and you know, at that stage, the economy seemed to be doing quite well. And then, of course, we had the vote, and it just got worse and worse. Still, the think tanks continued to pump out the dire predictions, which would then be picked up by the sort of likes of the BBC and sort of presented as if they were fact rather than as the sort of modelled scenarios. And the sort of real life data, which was showing the economy was actually doing quite well, you know, that was sort of overlooked. So yeah, it began very, very soon. Of course, you know, the idea that we would descending into this sort of hellhole of xenophobia and racism. Well, you know, research after research shows that Britain is just about the least racist, least xenophobic country in Europe, alongside, I think, Portugal. You know, if you want nutty far-right parties, go and it's mainland Europe, you'll find them. Britain doesn't have a functioning far-right party at the moment. And, you know, so many of the things which were sort of predicted for Britain are actually happening abroad rather than in Britain. And there was no sort of objective analysis of what was going on. And, of course, you know, the big story of the past 10 years or 9 years since the vote is that we had this devastating pandemic which completely changed the economic picture for a couple of years. The whole economies were shut down. And then we had the Ukraine war, which again, you know, created an energy crisis, took down European economies. You know, those are the two big influences over economic life in Britain and the continent over the past few years, and Brexit is really a much less important influence on what's happened.
Yeah, I think the extent to which Brexit has been blamed for every problem that has afflicted Britain over the past 8 or 9 years is quite extraordinary. I mean, every time a factory closed, or every time there were job losses, or every time a new kind of recessionary style event took place, it was instantly chalked up to Brexit when nothing else was taken into consideration, not the pre-existing economic problems in the UK, not the pandemic, as you say, and not the energy crisis and the Ukraine war. It was just instantly Brexit. And I wanted to ask you about how delusional that was, and what you think caused that tendency to blame everything on Brexit. Because there's a really striking part in the book where you talk about how, because this stuff really lingered, and you make the point that in 2022, Mark Carney, who was then the governor of the bank, the former governor of the Bank of England, he said that in 2016, the British economy was 90% the size of Germany's, and now it is less than 70% the size of Germany's. And instantly that gets chalked up to Brexit. It's held up as proof that this was a suicidal vote and was an extraordinary act of self-harm. But claims like that weren't quite true, were they? Could you tell us a bit more about that? And also why you think they were so obsessed with pinning everything on Brexit?
Yeah, well, that particular analysis by Mark Carney sort of relied on looking at the size of the economy, you know, at the sort of current exchange rate. And of course, currencies fluctuate, and with it, the sort of GDP, if you pair it back to dollar terms, the GDP of Britain, Germany, and every other country will go up and down sort of quite sharply every day with the currency. You know, the proper way to compare economies is through something called purchasing power parity, which takes into account local living costs. It takes out the sort of short-term exchange fluctuations. And, you know, once you take those out and you look at purchasing power parity and compare the economies Britain and Germany on that basis, well, then the, you know, the disparity disappears. The UK economy economy relative to that of Germany has not really changed in the 9 years since Brexit. So, that was a sort of typical case, really, of how the debate was sort of manipulated to make it seem as if Brexit was this terrible act of self-harm.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
.uk/Brendan.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Absolutely. Yeah, and people are a little bit allergic to nuance these days, I think. Let's talk a little bit about Germany and the German experience as well. Because, you know, if someone who just had a fleeting look at some of the mainstream coverage in Britain of European affairs over the past few years, they would be forgiven for thinking that Britain has gone to hell in a handcart and Germany is doing pretty well. It's simply not true. You illustrate that very well in the book. But there is this sense amongst the kind of chattering classes in Britain that Germany is just a better country than Britain. And you mentioned John Kampfner's book, Why the Germans Do It Better, Notes from a Grown-Up Country. And there was this sense that Germany just is outdoing us on everything. Economically, on the pandemic, on its response to the pandemic, it's just doing things better because it's grown up, whereas we are a self-harming Brexity nation. That's not quite right, is it? Especially in relation to something like the pandemic. And I wanted to ask you if you could just say a bit more about this kind of chattering class obsession with Germany. Do you think it just harks back to a point that Orwell made many decades ago, which is that there is an instinct amongst the intellectuals of England to always look to Europe, to see Europe as being culturally and morally superior. Do you think there's that lingering tendency?
Well, yes, it's very much along those lines. So, I mean, what's happening in Germany really is what happened in Britain half a century ago. It's some industrial decline. You know, Germany's been an industrial powerhouse. It's kept a very large proportion of its economy. It is still in manufacturing relative to Britain, and indeed relative to France. But it's sort of run up against a bit of a brick wall in that, you know, China and other East Asian countries are sort of producing stuff cheaper and often better as well. And Germany is finding it hard to compete, and companies are often making the wrong decisions. Look at electric cars. I mean, German manufacturers don't want to make them. They have not found a formula where they can make an affordable electric car. And until they do that, you know, European motorists aren't going to buy them. And meanwhile, China has sort of mastered the art of making sort of low price and competitively priced electric cars, with the result they are selling in China, and now they are beginning to come to Europe. And that has that's wrong-sided the German motor industry, and the EU is sort of caught in this terrible place. I mean, does it impose tariffs on imports of Chinese electric cars, which many in the EU want to do? But if it does that, then China will retaliate with tariffs against German cars, and Germany is a big seller of cars in Europe. So, you know, there's no solution to this. There's no way out of the problem of being unable to compete with China, you know, other than to improve their designs, their manufacturing methods in Germany. So, yeah, in Britain, we do have this sort of inferiority complex, particularly when it comes to sort of German manufacturing. And I think it sort of rather blinds a lot of the sort of Ramoners from being able to see what is going on in Germany. But, you know, all the Germans are very aware what's going on there, and it's not good. So Germany is becoming relatively poorer. For 2 years, its economy has shrunk. It's making far fewer cars than it did at its peak in the sort of mid-2010s, and this car industry is back to sort of output levels it was in the 1990s. And, you know, the car industry is a very totemic industry in Germany, and where it leads, other industries are following.
Yeah, and there will be many reasons for Germany's current troubles, and you mentioned developments in China contributing to those troubles, and there will be other things too. But in relation to the European Union as an institution, as a kind of oligarchical institution, in my view, you used the word sclerotic to describe some of the attitudes in the EU in relation to industry, the economy, entrepreneurship, and other things that are essential to a thriving economic entity. And I wanted to ask you about the problem of regulation in the EU and what role you think that plays in, I guess, being an albatross around the neck of this institution. And you give a couple of examples where the EU often seems very reluctant to embrace new technologies or new ideas and has this instinct to overregulate them or to be very wary of them. You give the example of genetic modification, genetically modified foodstuffs, which the EU was scared off for a very long time, and you give the more current example of AI and artificial intelligence, which the EU seems to be wary of as well, whereas other parts of the world are kind of pushing forward with this new technology. What do you think motors that you refer to as regulating to death? What do you think motors that, and how damaging is that for the European Union and its member states?
Well, I think the EU takes a sort of heritage approach to industry. It looks at an industry in Europe and the jobs and surrounds it and thinks, the first instinct, this has to be preserved and defended against competition from abroad and competition from things which are new. And, you know, the US, where economic growth has been sort of twice that of Europe for the past 25 years, you know, has taken a very different approach. It sort of embraces new things, and if that kills off the old industries, well, so be it. That's just what happens. But genetically modified crops is a prime example of this, because 25 years ago, Europe and Britain in particular, you know, were very well placed to take a lead in that then emerging industry. And it was effectively killed off by EU regulations, which made carrying out field trials virtually impossible. So the industry left, it went to the United States, went to the Far East, went to South America, where a lot of the field trials and so on were carried out. But at the same time, you know, this was all done sort of supposedly in the name of consumers, food safety for consumers. But in the event, we've ended up eating GM foods anyway, because, you know, if you want to buy soya, and soya's a sort of a product which is used particularly in vegetarian foods, I have to say, well, you cannot buy non-GM food sort of on a non-GM soya on the global markets, because it's just all mixed together as one commodity. So, you know, Europeans often unknowingly consume these genetically modified foods anyway, and they don't grow extra ears and develop cancer as a result of all the other scare stories we were told at the time. But what, you know, has resulted from that, we've just lost an industry which we could have been enriching us. Similar thing went on with fracking. You know, Europe didn't quite outlaw it, but it made it very, very difficult to conduct fracking in Europe. With the result now is we are absolutely reliant on fracked gas from the US, which we're importing in refrigerated ships, liquefied natural gas, which has sort of helped save our economies. You know, following the Ukraine war, when the gas taps were turned off from Russia. So again, you know, we're consuming shale gas, fracked gas. So we can't claim to be sort of environmentally pure in that respect, but we're just not making money from it. And, you know, our balance of payments as a result is, not helped by importing a commodity which we could be producing ourselves. And, you know, there's so many things like that which Europe has sort of sought to smother and US has embraced. And as you say, AI is the sort of next big battleground. Europe is currently fighting through its sort of how to regulate AI. And again, you know, it's taking this very, very precautionist approach, which, is smothering innovation.
In relation to Brexit Britain, then, because I think your description of the European Union's regulatory system is very well put. It's very well put in the book as well. What do you think explains Brexit Britain's failure thus far to make the most of the fact that it has escaped that smothering, as you refer to it? Because you talk in the book, you quote Larry Elliott from The Guardian, who makes the point that our economic performance since Brexit has been mediocre, but it hasn't been the full-on horror show that was promised by the kind of mystic megs of the think tank world. You go on to say that it hasn't been a disaster. Brexit Britain is not going down the toilet economically, but we haven't made the most of the opportunities that Brexit might present to us. And escaping from some of that regulatory system is a good example of something that we might make more of. You know, that liberation from a pretty sclerotic economic and regulatory system. Why do you think that is? I mean, partly, I presume, it's because we currently live under a pretty depressing, ambitionless Labour government. But across the political class, there doesn't seem to be that hunger to remake Britain in a new direction following our leaving of the EU. What do you think explains that failure?
Well, I mean, it was always the case that the negative consequences of Brexit, there's a greater friction in trade and so on, would come up front immediately when we left, whereas the potential benefits of Brexit would come in the longer run. And even then, they would only come if we had a government which was prepared to take advantage of its freedoms. And you're right, we don't have. We've had a Conservative government, now we've got a Labour government, and neither have really shown much inclination to seize advantage. There are a few things. We've had trade deals with Australia and New Zealand. We've also joined the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a free trade area which are, you know, based around Pacific Rim countries, but there's no reason why Britain shouldn't join as well, and we have joined. We've also made it a little easier for gene editing technology, which is the sort of the onward development of genetic modification, if you like, is the sort of new version of that science. But, you know, that's probably about all. You know, we haven't deregulated. On the contrary, in some ways, we've gone further than the EU in its regulation, and the zero emission vehicle mandate is a prime example of that. You know, that insists that 28% of cars sold this year are pure electric, and that rises to 80% by 2030. Well, I mean, if we were in the EU, and that's the regulation, by the way, which was blamed for Stellantis, the parent company of Vauxhall, announcing the closure of the Luton factory in December. But, you know, if we're still in the EU, we wouldn't be under that system. We would be under a sort of slightly more relaxed timetable of turning to electric cars. So, you know, in some ways, our governments have actually loaded extra regulation on, which we wouldn't have had if we were in the EU. And that's sort of really quite bizarre, given that, you know, one of the prime reasons for leaving was to escape the overregulation and of energy policy generally. We're stuck in this, EU framework. Another little example, if you buy and sell a house, you've got to have a thing called an energy performance certificate. It's a complete farce because they're complete sort of guesswork, and you can get two properties. You get two EPCs done on the same property and you get a very different result, because they're not really telling you how energy efficient a property is. It is just sort of based on sort of assumptions and so on, which are often incorrect. Now, we could quite easily now do away with the EPC regime. It was introduced on, you know, as a condition of an EU directive. We could now abolish it. But we don't, and I don't understand why we can't go through all these regulations one by one and sort of rip them up as we go along. The last government did sort of, you know, announce a bonfire of EU-era regulations, but then it sort of pulled back on it. COVID was partly to blame, I suppose, in the sense that 2020... Boris Johnson and his government were probably all primed to seize the initiative and take advantage of our departure from the EU. And then within weeks, of course, we were sort of in the middle of this crisis, once in a century pandemic, and I suppose that stole the initiative. But even so, we're 5 years on now, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be taking advantage of. We just have not had a government which is minded to do so, and it seems that perversely, big state, big government, high public spending, high regulation, that sort of perversely sort of come into fashion a little more since we've left the EU. So it'll be a while yet, I think, before we have a government which is actually prepared to take advantage of Brexit.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And I wonder if you think it speaks to, I guess, the underlying issue with EU membership to begin with, in my view, as someone who's been Eurosceptic for a very long time, which is that in some ways it was, you know, that outsourcing that all the member states partake in, the outsourcing of, authority to Brussels in relation to regulation or freedom of movement questions or custom issues or even certain forms of lawmaking, you know, states have quite happily outsourced authority on some of those matters to European commissioners. Do you think that really sprung from a sense of decay within individual states themselves? So I guess the question I'm asking is, where would you put the emphasis? Is it that the European Union was a kind of a huge burden on our shoulders, and it wasn't until we wriggled free of it that we'd be able to do what we wanted to do? Or is it that the EU became a kind of excuse for a British political class and a British state that didn't really want to do much of that stuff anyway, and had lacked spark for some time, both economically and politically? So how would you put the emphasis in relation to the role that the EU plays for individual states?
Well, it depends what sort of individual state you are. Of course, you know, if you were an Eastern European country, free of the yoke of communism, then the EU offered a sort of quick route to the world of capitalism, free trade and so on. If you're a Southern European country, the EU provided a source of funds for investment. And, you know, for many years, Spain and Portugal, Greece and so on did very well from the transfer of money from Northern European countries. But I think there never was really any obvious reason why Britain should have wanted to be part of the EU. To be part of a free trade area, certainly, and we were prior to the being in the EU, of course, we were in the European Free Trade Area, which was a rival group of countries at the time who were proposing free trade, but without the, political, the political aspects of it. And I think no government ever really came to terms with the idea of surrendering sovereignty, no UK government, that is. And, you know, it came to a head numerous times during our membership. And but I think it's left its imprint in that, you know, having been subject to these external imposition of rules for 46 years, we find it very hard to, you know, go our own way. And, I think in the minds of the sort of British civil servants, you know, we've never really left the EU, and they still want to be within the sphere of influence of its regulations, which is sort of why we don't sort of really get anywhere.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's well put. In the book, you say that Europe is at risk of becoming a backwater. In fact, it's become a backwater. And, You talk about how if you want to see economic dynamism, you've got to look to the United States or to parts of Asia. If you want to see cultural and educational excellence, you've got to look to Southeast Asia and Australia, other parts of the Southern Hemisphere, whereas Europe is kind of lingering behind on those incredibly important things. But then I guess the point people would have made in the past is that, well, at least Europe has got great culture and great history and wonderful cities and an attachment to the ideals of freedom and democracy. But in the book, almost chapter by chapter, you kind of pick apart some of those myths, that Europe is still a shining beacon of those kinds of values and that kind of culture. And I did want to ask you about some of that, because sometimes the Remainer argument enters, you know, the zone of fairy tales, the way in which they talk about the European Union as this kind of, you know, the apex of culture and civilization and democracy, and none of which is particularly true. And I did want to ask you about the racism and crime issue in particular, because that's one thing we were told about Brexit Britain, that it would become a hate crime hellhole. There would be a general destabilization. Things would go horribly wrong. But if you look across the channel at Europe, they have a worse racism problem than ours by most polling accounts. Crime is worsening in some countries, even in Sweden, where gang crime is spinning ever so slightly out of control. Sweden having previously been the kind of social democratic dream of kind of Guardian columnists. What is the situation like in Europe in relation to, I guess, general social peace? I mean, things do seem to be unraveling in some countries there.
Well, they are. I mean, we've seen, go back a year and you remember there's a great protest by farmers and sort of Brussels ministries being besieged by tractors and so on. And what I found remarkable there was that French farmers in particular, when they started sort of putting roadblocks on motorways, is they were objecting to food imports from Spain and from Italy. And another, if you look at, there was a wonderful poll that is quoted in the book, I forget who carried it out, but just to simply ask people whether they were prepared to eat foreign food or not. And Britain came sort of top of the list of European countries. We were very happy to eat our food from imported food from other countries. Whereas Italy, I think, was in particular was worse. Few Italians, it seemed, were prepared to eat tomatoes which were grown outside of Italy. You see this sort of, the single market has been held up as this great symbol of civilization, where culture of products, produce and people are shared from one country to another. You've got free movement and everything. And, it seems that large numbers of Europeans don't actually believe that. They feel frightened of the idea of buying products from other countries. Free movement's another issue, of course, another great cornerstone of European civilization, we're told, the idea that you can go and live and work in another country if you feel like it. But, look what's happened since Brexit. We've got Germany now sort of reintroducing border controls, quite against the spirit of the Schengen agreement. We've got Hungary's built a Donald Trump style razor wire fence on its southern border to keep out the migrants. We've got, Spanish towns sort of rising up against tourism, tourists go home, and all those sort of slogans we're getting. And, Europe is not exactly espousing those civilized values that we were told we would lose when we left the EU. And I don't think we have many people in Britain sort of waving pitchforks at tourists. We're very happy to import our food, even if we're not a part of the EU and so on. So, I think Britain in some ways actually is more a keeper of the sort of civilized values that we're told are peculiar to EU membership. And while many European countries sort of fall short on these ideals in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And in relation to the questions of freedom and democracy, which are questions I take very seriously indeed, we are often told that modern Europe, post-war Europe, as these kind of Europe-wide institutions have been growing and then they've kind of formed into the EU, We're often told that they embody those values in particular. From the ashes of the horrors of Nazism, Europe created this kind of citadel of liberal ideals and democratic ideals. And you talk in your book about how that is not quite true. One of the main reasons I have been a long-term Eurosceptic is because of Europe's attitude towards democracy in particular, the way in which it quite cavalierly will brush aside votes that it doesn't like. For example, when the Irish voted against the Nice Treaty and then against the Lisbon Treaty, when Greek people have voted for governments that the Europe disapproves of. I mean, there are various examples where the European Union has wielded its power almost to punish national populations for voting in a way that it doesn't like. And in your book, you talk about the example of the Law and Justice Party in Poland. They were in power until the end of 2023, I think. And the EU was quite fond of wrapping their knuckles and telling them that there were certain laws that they had to pass and certain laws that they shouldn't pass. And there are numerous examples of that happening in the EU over the past few years. And it really gives the lie, doesn't it, to this notion that the European Union is this happy-clappy protector of democracy, when even within its own boundaries, it actually often behaves in a quite undemocratic way.
Yeah. If you want to understand the difference between the European approach to democracy and the American approach to democracy, I recommend going and reading the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights and compare it with the European Convention on Human Rights. The two documents, quite similar in many ways, which were drafted around about the same time, late 40s, early 50s. But the first of them, the UN document, was heavily influenced by American lawyers, and the European document, of course, was drawn up by British and other European lawyers. And there's one phrase which appears in the UN document, but which appears absolutely nowhere in the European document, and that is, "Government shall be by the will of the people." And ever since the foundation of the EU, and prior to that, the European recovery from Second World War, if you like, through such things as the European Convention on Human Rights, that's all. The basic difference is that the Europeans were sort of frightened of democracy because they looked at what happened in Nazi Germany and they said, well, look, this is what democracy gives us. It's what unbridled democracy gives us. And they started to construct institutions which would protect against people power too much, which would sort of put this cordon sanitaire around governments and institutions to stop them being influenced by populist movements. And Americans have never seen the need to do that. There's a much greater trust in the will of the people. And it really does explain, you know, why we've ended up with this democratic deficit in Europe, which, you know, is much less evident in the United States. And, you know, the examples you gave, you know, are very good. The EU doesn't trust it. You know, if a country votes against a referendum which it wants them to vote for, you know, they'll go and ask them to vote again. Sorry, that was the wrong result. You know, have another go, have another try, you know, like a teacher giving a kid a sort of tell him go and do your homework again. And you know, that is why we ended up with a referendum with us and a campaign to leave with the slogan "Take Back Control," because that absolutely summed up the problem of EU membership, was that the democratic deficit was, you know, was removing the sort of will of people from government.
I think, you know, it's long been my view that the institutions of the EU are primarily designed to insulate decision making from publics rather than to really open up democracy in a new or interesting way. And I think the European Commission in particular sums up that process of kind of insulating political life from pesky people. That really is what that's about. Just a couple more questions for you, Ross. I wanted to ask you about whether you think the EU's days might be numbered, or its years numbered, rather, because it's not going to collapse anytime soon. But it does seem to me that there's a contradictory process going on at the moment. So on the one hand, There has been what is sometimes referred to as a vibe shift. There is now a growing interest in the idea of sovereignty and protecting our borders, as you've said. Countries in Europe are taking measures to ring fence themselves from out of control immigration and food imports or whatever else it might be. And we see this reflected in political life. Lots of ordinary people, for example, are very keen that Britain gets control of its borders, and in America they want control at the southern border. There is this renewed belief that a sovereign state should have to protect the right to protect its sovereign territory. And that's happening in Europe too. But at the same time, there is a reluctance, even among some of the populist parties in Europe, even with Marine Le Pen and Meloni in Italy and other organizations, they are very good at criticizing the EU, but there is a reluctance to really break away from it in the way that we in the UK did. What do you think explains that kind of contradictory process? And what do you think will win out? Will the renewed belief in sovereign independence win out against the kind of globalist instincts of the European Union?
Yeah, it is very interesting the way with the National Front as it was, National Rally as it is now, and the AfD in Germany, for example, and Freedom Party in the Netherlands. They all began, or they went through phases of being very, very anti-Europe, was standing for advocating leaving the EU, and sort of one by one they sort of soften and then drop that stance. And I think one of the factors is that I think their strategy now is to sort of change the EU, and rather than to simply leave it, and to sort of seize the initiative to in the way we've seen over the Schengen Agreement, for example, the way that, you know, it's supposed to mean open borders, but it turns out that countries can, if they fancy, actually override it, and that sort of national concerns, nation states are a little more powerful than often we were perhaps led to believe they were during the Brexit debate. And, you know, I've often thought, and this is one of the reasons why I voted Remain in the end. I mean, it was about sort of 50-50 for me. I'm sort of one of those few, but I feel sometimes the only person in Britain who thought there were good arguments on both sides. But I mean, one of the reasons I ended up voting Remain was I thought, well, actually some of these things we can achieve without going through the turmoil of leaving the EU, and without losing some of the nice things like free movement, the right to go and live in another country. Was that, you looked at, say, Ireland, which managed to have a 12.5% corporation tax rate in spite of being in the EU, and the way that, some countries are managing to keep their migration levels very low, illegal migration rates very low. Hungary, for example, hardly takes any illegal migrants, and they're still members of the EU. And, I think it was perhaps sort of underestimated during the Brexit campaign, the Leave campaign, that actually some of the things that we wanted to achieve by, getting out the clutches of the EU, we might be able to achieve actually without leaving the EU. And I think, over time since Brexit, countries have become a lot more muscular in standing up to the EU, whether it's the Law and Justice Party in Poland, whether it's German government reintroducing border controls and so on. There is now a much stronger approach to dealing with the EU and not allowing its sort of strictures and directives to wholly to dictate what individual countries do. And I mean, it was always the case, of course, that Britain took a lot of these directives a lot more literally than some other countries did. But I think the EU is probably not going to implode in the way that I think some of us thought it might do in the immediate wake of Brexit. But I do think it's going to weaken. It's going to continue to weaken. And, in the end, we might even end up with a sort of EU which we were happy to be part of. If it were to be returned to the free trade area that we thought that many people hoped it would be and nothing else, then probably something that we would rejoin. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, not for a generation at least.
Okay, Ross, my last question for you is about, I guess, the elephant in the room, whose name is Donald Trump. And I want to ask you what impact you think the pretty tumultuous events in the United States might have on, I guess, Brexit Britain and also Europe. And it's, you know, just watching what's happening this week, you know, with the kind of bonfire of the bureaucracy that is taking place in the US, and seems to me almost like the kind of slightly ruthless dismantling of an entire ruling class ideology, everything from DEI to net zero to border issues, everything that has been a kind of fashionable belief of the Western elites for the past two or three decades has just been put to the fire. And it's fascinating to watch. And I wonder what impact you think that might make. There's obviously quaking in Brussels over the prospect of a Trump-ruled America. There's lots of concern. Do you think a Trumpist United States will have a positive or negative impact on Europe and on the problems that you outline so well in the book?
Well, it's going to deepen the gulf between the US and the EU way of doing things, particularly on the energy issue. You know, Europe seems stuck in this sort of pretty suicidal energy policy where it's sort of putting net zero against all, above all economic considerations, and is sort of happy to lose its manufacturing industries, and sort of impoverish its people as a result. Well, America was never going to do that, and even during the Biden years, it followed a very aggressive policy of national energy security through the exploitation of fossil fuels. Well, you know, that's going to become even more evident now, isn't it? Energy is already, about a quarter of the price in US as it is for industrial users in Britain. Well, that gulf is going to increase, and that is going to benefit the US relative to Europe. As for trade, now that's something which we're going to have to wait and see a bit, because Trump obviously does fire from the hip on these kind of issues. And last time he threatened tariffs and global trade wars and so on. But within months, he was sitting in a G8 summit asking, why don't we go to zero tariffs everywhere? And he puts up these sort of things as opening negotiating positions. And I suspect he doesn't really intend to impose those very high tariff rates he's advocating at the moment. If he did, it would be, a very dark time for the world as a whole, because trade barriers always make people poorer ultimately. But, if he's more sensible, we will have a bit of competition between EU and the US. We will have a sort of skirmishes on the trade front, but I don't think we will probably have an all-out trade war. So in that sense, and I hope I'm right in saying so, that there won't be a huge consequence of the Trump presidency.
Ross, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe, and in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.